They were well rested and well fed, and they soon reached a pond where they could drink. The retriever had told them to be on the lookout for it. It would not have been safe for them to drink from his bowl again. Too many humans were now about. And their spirits were far higher than when they'd left the house in Regent's Park. How far away it already seemed, although it was less than 24 hours since they'd been in their baskets by the kitchen fire. Of course, they were still anxious about their puppies, and sorry for the poor dearlies. But Lucky's message had been cheering, and they hoped to make it all up to the dearlies one day. And anyway, as Pongo said, worrying would help nobody, while enjoying their freedom to race across the fields would do them a power of good. He was relieved to see how well Mrs. ran, and what good condition she was in. So much food had been given to her while she was feeding the puppies that she had never got pitifully thin, as Perdita had when she had fed her own puppies without being given extra food. "You are a beautiful dog, Missus," said Pongo. "I am very proud of you." At this, Missus looked even more beautiful, and Pongo felt even prouder of her. After a minute or so, he said, "Do you think I'm looking pretty fit?" Missus told him he looked magnificent, and wished she'd said so without being asked. He was not a vain dog, but every husband likes to know that his wife admires him. They ran on, shoulder to shoulder, a perfectly matched couple. The night was windless, and therefore seemed warmer than the night before, but Pongo knew there was a heavy frost. And when, after a couple of hours across the fields, they came to another pond, there was a film of ice over it. They broke this easily and drank, but Pongo began to be a little anxious about where they would be by daybreak, for they would need good shelter in such cold weather. As they were now travelling across country, he thought it unlikely they would find the village that had been expecting them. But he felt sure most dogs would by now have heard of them, and would be willing to help. "Only we must be near some village by dawn, or we shall meet no dogs," he thought. Soon after that, a lane crossed the fields, and as they had just heard a church clock strike midnight, Pongo felt there was now little chance of their meeting any humans on the road. He wanted to find a signpost and make sure they were travelling in the right direction. So they went along the lane for a mile until they came to a sleeping village. There was a signpost on the green, which Pongo read by the light of the moon. He was very good at reading. As a pup, he had played with alphabet blocks. All was well. Their journey across the fields had saved them many miles, and they were now deep in Essex. The village where they might have stayed was already behind them. By going north, they would reach Suffolk. The only depressing thing was that the wonderful steak dinner seemed such a long time ago, and there was no hope of getting food as late as this. They just had to go on and on through the night, getting hungrier and hungrier. And by the time it began to get light, they were also extremely chilly, partly because they were hungry and tired, and partly because it was getting colder and colder. The ice on the ponds they passed was thicker and thicker. At last they came to a pond where they could not break through to drink. And now Pongo was really anxious, for they'd reached a part of the country where there seemed to be very few villages. Where could they get food and shelter? Where could they hide and sleep during the bitterly cold day ahead of them? He did not tell Missus of his fears, and she would not even admit that she was hungry. But her tail drooped, and her pace got slower and slower. He felt terrible, tired, hungry, anxious, and deeply ashamed that he was letting his beautiful wife suffer hardship. Surely there would be a village soon, or a fair-sized farm. "Should we rest a little, Pongo?" said Missus at last. "Not until we've found some dogs to help us, Missus," said Pongo. Then his heart gave a glad leap. Ahead of them were some thatched cottages. It was full daylight now, and he could see smoke twisting up from several chimneys. Surely some dog would be about. "If anyone tries to catch us, we must take to the fields and run," said Pongo. "Yes, Pongo," said Missus, though she did not now feel she could run very far. They reached the first cottage. Pongo gave a low bark. No dog answered it. They went on, and soon saw that this was not a real village, but just a short row of cottages, some of them empty and almost in ruins. Except for smoke rising from a few chimneys, there was no sign of life until they came to the very last cottage. As they reached it, a little boy looked out of a window. He saw them and quickly opened the cottage door. In his hand was a thick slab of bread and butter. He appeared to be holding it out to them.
"Gently, Pongo," said Mrs., "or we shall frighten him."
They went through the open gate and up the cobbled path, wagging their tails and looking with love at the little boy and the bread and butter. The child smiled at them fearlessly and waved the bread and butter. And then, when they were only 3 or 4 yards away, he stooped, picked up a stone, and slung it with all his force. He gave a squeal of laughter when he saw the stone strike Pongo, then went in and slammed the door. At that moment, the dogs heard a man's voice inside the cottage. They turned and ran as fast as they could along the road and then into a field.
"Are you hurt, Pongo?" cried Mrs. as they ran.
Then she saw that he was limping. They stopped behind a haystack. Pongo's leg was bleeding. The stone must have had a very sharp edge. But what hurt him most was the bruise on the bone. He was trembling with pain and rage. Mrs. was terrified, but she did not let him see this. She licked his wound and said there was nothing a good rest would not cure.
"Rest? Where?" said Pongo.
Mrs. saw that the haystack was very loosely made. She scrabbled at it fiercely, saying,
"Look, Pongo, you can creep in and get warm, then sleep for a while. I will find us some food. I will. The first dog I meet will help me."
By now she had made a large hole in the haystack. Pongo looked at it longingly. But no, he could not let her go alone. He struggled to his feet, wincing with pain, and said,
"I must come with you to find food, and I will bite that child."
"No, Pongo, no," cried Mrs., horrified. "Remember, he is only a very young human. All very young creatures are ignorantly cruel. Often our dear puppies hurt me badly, not knowing they were doing so. To bite a human is the greatest crime a dog can commit. You shall not let that cruel, thoughtless child put such a sin on your conscience. Your pain and anger will pass, but the guilt would remain with you for always."
Pongo knew she was right, and already the desire to bite the child was passing.
"But I won't let you go alone," he said. "Then let us both rest a while first," said crafty Mrs. "Come on, there's room for two."
And she crept into the haystack.
"We should find food first, or we shall be too weak to find it when we wake up," said Pongo.
But he followed her into the haystack.
"Just sleep for a few minutes, Pongo, while I keep guard," said Mrs. coaxingly.
Pongo could fight on no longer. Sleep came to him while he thought he was still arguing. Mrs. waited a few minutes, then crept out and pulled hay round Pongo to hide him. She no longer felt sleepy. She was far too anxious. Even her appetite had gone for the moment. Still, she knew she must find food for them both, and she had no idea how to, for she was almost sure there was no dog anywhere near to help her. But pretending to Pongo that she felt brave had made her really feel a little braver, and her tail was no longer down. She could still see the thatched cottages, and she noticed some hens at the back of them. Perhaps the hens would have some stale crusts that she could, well, borrow. She went back. The first cottage she reached was the one where the little boy lived, and now he was at the back, staring at her. This time he had an even larger slab of bread and butter with some jam on it. He ran towards her, holding it out.
"Perhaps he really means it now," thought Mrs. "Perhaps he's sorry he hurt Pongo."
And she went forward hopefully, though well prepared to dodge stones. The child waited until she was quite close. Then again he stooped for a stone. But he was on a patch of grass with no stones handy. So instead, he threw the slab of bread and butter. He threw it with rage, not love. But that made it no less valuable. Mrs. caught it neatly and bolted.
"Bless me," she thought, "he's just a small human who likes throwing things. His parents should buy him a ball."
She took the bread and butter back to the haystack and laid it down by her sleeping husband's nose. So far, she had not even licked it, but now she let herself nibble off one very small corner. It tasted so glorious that her appetite came back with a rush, but she left all the rest for Pongo to find when he woke. Again she pulled the hay round him, and then ran to the road. But she saw a man outside the cottage where the little boy lived, so she did not dare to go back to visit the hens. She ran in the opposite direction. It was now a very beautiful winter morning. Every blade of grass was silvered with hoarfrost and glittering in the newly risen sun. But Mrs. was far too worried to enjoy the beauty. The triumph of getting the bread was wearing off, and all sorts of fears were rushing at her. Suppose Pongo was seriously injured? Suppose he was too lame to go on? Suppose she could find no food close at hand? If she had to go far, she knew she would get lost. She even got lost in Regent's Park almost every time the Dearleys were off the leash. They often laughed at the way she would stand still, wildly staring round for them. Suppose she never found her way back to Pongo, and he searched and searched, and never found her. Lost dog! The very words were terrible. And was she, even now, quite sure of her way back to the haystack? It isn't fair, thought Mrs. No one as worried as I am ought to feel hungry, too, for she was ravenous and thirsty. She tried licking the ice in a ditch, but it hurt her tongue without quenching her thirst. She was beginning to think she must go back and make sure where the haystack was, when she came to an old red brick archway leading to a long gravel drive. Her spirits rose. Surely this must be the entrance to some big country house, such as she'd stayed at several times when she and Mrs. Dearley were both bachelors. Such houses had many dogs, large kitchens, plenty of food. Joyfully she ran through the archway. She could see no house ahead of her because the drive twisted. It was overgrown with weeds, and it went on so long that she began to wonder if it really did lead to a house. Indeed, it was now so wild and neglected that it seemed more like a path through a wood than the approach to a house. And it was so strangely silent. Never in her life had Mrs. felt quite so alone. More and more frightened, she ran round one more bend, and suddenly she was out in the open, with the house in front of her. It was very old, built of mellow red brick like the archway, with many little diamond-paned windows, and one great window that reached almost to the roof. The windows twinkling in the early morning sunshine looked cheerful and welcoming, but there was no sign of life anywhere, and there was grass growing in the cracks of the wide stone steps, which led to the massive oak door. "It's empty," thought Mrs. in despair. But it was not empty. Looking out of an open window was a spaniel, black except for his muzzle, which was grey with age. "Good morning," he said, most courteously. "Can I be of any help to you, my dear?" It was wonderful how quickly the spaniel took in the story Mrs. poured out to him, for he had not heard any news by way of the twilight barking. "Haven't listened to it for years," he said. "Indeed, I doubt if I could get it now. There isn't another dog for miles. Anyway, Sir Charles needs me at twilight. He needs me almost all the time. I'm only off duty now because he's in his bath." They were now in a large stone-floored kitchen, where the spaniel had led Mrs. after inviting her to jump in through the window. He went on, "Breakfast before you tell me any more, young lady." And he led her to a large plate of meat. "But it's your breakfast," said Mrs., trying not to look as hungry as she felt. "No, it isn't. It's my supper, if you really want to know. I'd no appetite, and I shan't have any for breakfast, which will be served to me any minute. Tea's my meal. Hurry up, my dear. It will be thrown away if you don't eat it." Mrs. took one delicious gulp. Then she stopped. "My husband," the spaniel interrupted her. "We'll see about his breakfast later. Finish it all, my child." So Mrs. ate and ate, and then had a long drink from a white pottery bowl. She had never seen a bowl like it. "That's an 18th-century dog's drinking bowl," said the spaniel, "handed down from dog to dog in this family. And now, before you get too sleepy, you'd better bring your husband here.
Oh, yes, said Mrs. eagerly. Please tell me how to get back to the haystack.
Just go to the end of the drive and turn left.
I'm not very good at right and left, said Mrs. Especially left.
The spaniel smiled, then looked at her paws. This will help you, he said. That paw with the pretty spot, that is your right paw.
Then which is my left paw?
Why, the other paw, of course.
Back or front?
Asked Mrs. Just forget your back paws.
Mrs. was puzzled. Could she forget her back paws? And if she could, would it be safe?
The spaniel went on. Look at your front paws and remember, right paw, spot, left paw, no spot.
Mrs. stared hard at her paws.
I will practice, she said earnestly. But please tell me how to turn left.
Turn on the side of the paw which does not have a spot.
Whichever way I'm going?
Certainly, said the spaniel. The paw with the spot will always be your right paw. You can depend on that.
If I turned towards you now, would I be turning left?
Asked Mrs. after thinking very hard.
Yes, yes, splendid, said the spaniel.
Mrs. then turned round and faced the other way.
But now you are on the side of the paw with the spot, she said worriedly. So my right paw has turned into my left.
The spaniel gave it up.
I will show you the haystack, he said,
and led her out through what once must have been a fine kitchen garden, but was now a mass of weeds. Beyond it were the fields. Mrs. could just see the thatched cottages and the haystack.
It's the only haystack, said the spaniel. All the same, keep your eyes on it all the time you run. I would come with you, but my rheumatism prevents me, and Sir Charles will need me to carry his spectacle case downstairs. We are an old, old couple, my dear. He is 90, and I, according to a foolish human reckoning that 1 year of a dog's life represents 7 years of human life, I am 105.
I should never have guessed it, said Mrs. politely and truthfully.
Anyway, I'm still young enough to know a pretty dog when I see one, said the spaniel gallantly. Now off you go for your husband. You'll have no difficulty in finding your way back because you will see our chimneys from the haystack.
Right or left?
Asked Mrs. brightly.
In front of your delightful nose. If I'm not here, just take your husband into the kitchen and I'll join you as soon as I can.
Mrs. raced off happily across the frosty fields, never taking her eyes off the haystack, and feeling very proud when she reached it without getting lost. Pongo was still heavily asleep, with the bread and butter by his nose. Poor Pongo. Waking up was awful, what with his sleepiness, the pain in his leg, and his horror at learning Mrs. had been dashing about the countryside alone. But he felt better when she had told him the news, which she did while he ate the bread and butter. And though his leg hurt, he found he could run without limping. "Which way do we go?" he asked as they came out of the haystack. Mrs. looked worried. There were no chimneys ahead of her nose, because she was facing in exactly the opposite direction. But Pongo saw the chimneys and took her towards them. Just before they reached the kitchen garden, Mrs. said, "Pongo, do dogs have spots on their right paws or on their left paws?"
"Well, that depends on the dog," said Pongo.
Mrs. shook her head.
"It's hopeless," she thought. "How can I depend on a thing that depends?"
The spaniel was waiting for them.
"I've settled Sir Charles by the fire," he said, "so I've an hour or so to spare. Come to breakfast, my dear fellow."
He led Pongo to the kitchen, where there was now another plate of food.
"Surely it's your breakfast, sir," said Pongo.
"Had mine with Sir Charles. Don't, as a rule, take breakfast, but meeting your pretty wife gave me an appetite. So I accepted a couple of slices of bacon. Sir Charles was so pleased. Go ahead, my dear chap, I couldn't eat another bite."
So Pongo ate, and drank and drank.
"And now for a long sleep," said the spaniel.
He led them up a back staircase and along many passages till they came to a large sunny bedroom in which was a four-poster bed. Beside it was a round basket.
"Mine," said the spaniel, "but I never use it. Sir Charles likes me on the bed. Luckily, that's made already, because John, he's our valet, is already off for his day out. Jump up, both of you.
Pongo and Mrs. jumped onto the four-poster and relaxed in bliss.
No one will come up here until this evening, said the spaniel, because Sir Charles can't manage the stairs until John gets back. The fire should last some hours yet. We always light it for Sir Charles to have his bath in front of it. No newfangled plumbing in this house. Sleep well, my children.
The sunlight, the firelight, the tapestried walls were all so beautiful that it seemed a waste not to stay awake and enjoy them. So they did, for nearly a whole minute. The next thing they knew was that the spaniel was gently waking them. The sun was already down, the fire dead, the room a little chilly. Pongo and Mrs. stretched sleepily.
What you need is tea, said the spaniel. But first, a breath of air. Follow me.
There was still a faint glow from the sunset as they wandered round the wintry, tangled garden. As Pongo looked back towards the beautiful old red brick house, the spaniel told them it was 400 years old, and that nobody now lived there but himself, Sir Charles, and the valet John. Most of the rooms were shut up.
But we dust them sometimes, he said. That's a very long walk for me.
The great window was lit by the flicker of firelight.
It's in there we sit, mostly, the spaniel told them. We should be warmer in one of the smaller rooms, but Sir Charles likes to be in the great hall.
A silvery bell tinkled.
There! He's ringing for me. Tea's ready. Now, do just as I tell you.
He led them indoors and then into a large, high room, at the far end of which was an enormous fire. In front of it sat an old gentleman, but they could not yet see him very well because there was a screen round the back of his chair.
Please lie down at the back of the screen, whispered the spaniel. Later, Sir Charles will fall asleep, and you can come closer to the fire.
As Pongo and Mrs. tiptoed to the back of the screen, they noticed that there was a large table beside Sir Charles, on which was his luncheon tray, finished with now, and neatly covered by a table napkin, and everything necessary for tea. Water was already boiling in a silver kettle over a spirit lamp. Sir Charles filled the teapot and put the tea cosy on. Then he lifted a silver cover from a plate on which there were a number of slices of bread. By now the spaniel had joined him and was thumping his tail.
Hungry, are you? Said Sir Charles. Well, we've a good fire for our toast.
Then he put a slice of bread on a toasting fork. It was no ordinary toasting fork, for it was made of iron and nearly 4 feet long. It was really meant for pushing logs into position. But it was just what Sir Charles needed, and he handled it with great skill, avoiding the flaming logs and toasting the bread where the wood glowed red-hot. A slice of toast was ready in no time. Sir Charles buttered it thickly and offered a piece to the spaniel, who ate it while Sir Charles watched. Mrs. was a little surprised that the courteous spaniel had not offered her the first piece. She was even more surprised when he received a second piece and ate that too, while Sir Charles watched. She began to feel very hungry and very anxious. Surely the kind spaniel had not invited them to tea just to watch him eat. Then a third piece of toast was offered, and this time Sir Charles happened to turn away. Instantly the spaniel dropped the toast behind the screen. Piece after piece travelled this way to Pongo and Mrs., with the spaniel only eating one now and then, when Sir Charles happened to be looking. Mrs. felt ashamed of her hungry suspicions.
"Never known you with such a good appetite, my boy," said the old gentleman delightedly,
and he made slice after slice of toast until all the bread was gone. Then cakes were handed on in the same way, and then Sir Charles offered the spaniel a silver bowl of tea. This was put down so close to the edge of the screen that Pongo and Mrs. were able to drink some while Sir Charles was looking the other way. When he saw the bowl empty, he filled it again and again, so everyone had enough. Pongo and Mrs. had always had splendid food, but they had never before had hot buttered toast and sweet milky tea. It was a meal they always remembered. At last, Sir Charles rose stiffly, put another log on the fire, and then settled back in his chair and closed his eyes.
Soon he was asleep, and the spaniel beckoned Pongo and Mrs. to the fire. They sat on the warm hearth and looked up at the old gentleman. His face was deeply lined, and all the lines drooped, and somehow he had a look of the spaniel, or the spaniel had a look of Sir Charles. Both of them were lit by the firelight, and beyond them was the great window, now blue with evening.
"We ought to be on our way," whispered Pongo to Mrs.
But it was so warm, so quiet, and they were both so full of buttered toast that they drifted into a light and delightful sleep. Pongo awoke with a start. Surely someone had spoken his name. The fire was no longer blazing brightly, but there was still enough light to see that the old gentleman was awake and leaning forward.
"Well, if that isn't Pongo and his missus," he murmured smilingly. "Well, well, what a pleasure, what a pleasure."
Mrs. had opened her eyes now. The spaniel whispered, "Don't move, either of you."
"Can you see them?"
said the old gentleman, putting his hand on the spaniel's head.
"If you can, don't be frightened. They won't hurt you. You'd have liked them. Let's see, they must have died 50 years before you were born. More than that. They were the first dogs I ever knew. I used to ask my mother to stop the carriage and let them get inside. I couldn't bear to see them running behind. So, in the end, they just became house dogs. How often they sat there in the firelight. Hey, you two, if dogs can come back, why haven't you come back before?"
Then Pongo knew that Sir Charles thought they were ghost dogs, and he remembered that Mr. Dearley had named him Pongo because it was a name given to many Dalmatians of those earlier days when they ran behind carriages. Sir Charles had taken him and Mrs. for Dalmatians he had known in his childhood.
"Probably my fault," the old gentleman went on. "I've never been what they call psychic nowadays. This house is supposed to be full of ghosts, but I've never seen any. I dare say I'm only seeing you because I'm pretty close to the edge now. And quite timed, too. I'm more than ready. Well, what a joy to know that dogs go on, too. I've always hoped it. Good news for you, too, my boy."
He fondled the spaniel's ears.
"Well, Pongo and his pretty wife, after all these years. Can't see you so well now, but I shall remember."
The fire was sinking lower and lower. They could no longer see the old gentleman's face, but soon his even breathing told them he was asleep again. The spaniel rose quietly.
"Come with me now," he whispered, "for John will be back soon to get supper. You have given my dear old pet a great pleasure. I am deeply grateful."
They tiptoed out of the vast dark hall and made their way to the kitchen, where the spaniel pressed more food on them.
"Just a few substantial biscuits. My tin is always left open for me when John is away."
Then they had a last drink of water, and the spaniel gave Pongo directions for reaching Suffolk. It was full of rights and lefts, and Mrs. did not take in one word. The spaniel noticed her dazed look and said playfully,
"Now, which is your right paw?"
"One of the front ones," said Mrs. brightly,
at which Pongo and the spaniel laughed in a very masculine way. Then they thanked the spaniel and said goodbye. Mrs. said she would always remember that day.
"So shall I," said the spaniel, smiling at her. "Ah, Pongo, what a lucky dog you are."
"I know it," said Pongo, looking proudly at Mrs. Then they were off. After they'd been running across the fields for some minutes, Mrs. said anxiously,
"How's your leg, Pongo?"
"Much, much better. Oh, Mrs., I'm ashamed of myself. I made such a fuss this morning. It was partly rage. Pain hurts more when one is angry. You were such a comfort to me, and so brave."
"And you were a comfort to me the night we left London," said Mrs. "It will be all right as long as we never lose courage both together."
"I'm glad you did not let me bite that small human."
"Nothing should ever make a dog bite a human," said Mrs. in a virtuous voice. Pongo remembered something.
"You said only the night before last
that you were going to tear Cruella de Vil to pieces.
That is different, said Mrs. Grimley. I do not consider Cruella de Vil is human.
Thinking of Cruella made them anxious for the puppies, and they ran on faster, without talking any more for a long time.
Then Mrs. said, Pongo, how far away from the puppies are we now?
With good luck, we should reach them tomorrow morning, said Pongo. Just before midnight, they came to the market town of Sudbury. Pongo paused as they crossed the bridge over the River Stour.
Here we enter Suffolk, he said triumphantly.
They ran on through the quiet streets of old houses and into the market square. They had hoped they might meet some dog and hear if any news of the puppies had come at the twilight barking, but not so much as a cat was stirring. While they were drinking at the fountain, church clocks began to strike midnight. Mrs. said gladly,
Oh, Pongo, it's tomorrow. Now we shall be with our puppies today.
As the night wore on, they travelled through many pretty villages to a countryside wilder than any they had yet seen. There were more woods and heaths, fewer farms. So wild was it that Pongo would risk no shortcuts and stuck cautiously to the roads, which were narrow and twisted. The moon was behind clouds, so he could not read what few signposts there were.
I'm so afraid we may go through our village without knowing it, he said, for as we have not been able to send any news by the twilight barking, nobody will be on the lookout for us. But he was wrong. Suddenly, out of the darkness, came a loud meow.
They stopped instantly. Just ahead of them, up a tree, was a tabby cat. She said,
Pongo and Missus, I suppose you are friendly?
Yes, indeed, madam, said Pongo. Are you, by any chance, the cat who helped to find our puppies?
That's me, said the cat.
Oh, thank you, cried Missus.
The cat jumped down.
Sorry to seem suspicious of you, but some dogs just can't control themselves when they see a cat. Not that I've ever had any trouble.
Well, here you are.
How very kind of you to keep watch for us, madam, said Pongo.
No hardship. I'm usually out at night. You can call me Tib. My real name's Pussy Willow, but that's too long for most people. A pity, really, as it's a name I could fancy.
It suits you so well, said Pongo, in a courtly tone he had picked up from the spaniel, with your slender figure and soft grey paws. He was taking a chance in saying this, for it was too dark for him to see her figure, let alone her paws. The cat was delighted.
Well, I have kept my figure, and it was my paws got me the name of Pussy Willow. Now you'll be wanting a bite of food and a good long rest.
Please tell us if all is well with our puppies, said Missus.
It was yesterday afternoon when I last saw them. Lively as crickets and fat as butter they were.
Could we see them, just a glimpse, before we eat or sleep?
Asked Missus.
We can't climb trees as Mrs. Willow can, said Pongo. You won't need to, said the cat. The Colonel's made other arrangements, but you can't see the puppies before they're let out for exercise, and that'll be ours yet. Those baddens are late risers. Well, come along and meet the Colonel.
A human Colonel? Asked Missus, puzzled.
Bless me, no. The Colonel's our sheepdog.
A perfect master of strategy, you ask the sheep. He calls me his lieutenant.
The cat was now leading them along the road. Pongo asked how far it was to the farm.
Oh, we're not going to the farm now. The Colonel's spending the night at the Folly. Crazy place, but it's coming in very useful.
The darkness was thinning. Soon the road ran across a stretch of heath, on which, still some way ahead of them, a dark mass stood out against the gradually lightening sky. After a few moments, Pongo saw that the dark mass was a great stone wall.
There you are, said the cat. Your puppies are behind that.
It looks like the wall of a prison, said Pongo.
Nasty place, said the cat. The Colonel will tell you its history.
She led them from the road over the rough grass of the heath. As they drew nearer, Pongo saw that the wall curved as the wall of a round tower curves. Above it rose the trunks of tall trees, their bare branches black against the sky.
You'd think there would be a castle at least inside that huge wall, said the cat. And they do say there was going to be, only something went wrong. All that's there now, well, you can see for yourself.
She led the way to the rusty iron gates and Pongo and Mrs. peered through the bars. There was now enough light for them to see some distance. Beyond a stretch of grass as wild as the surrounding heath, they saw the glint of water. But strangely, it seemed to be black water. Then they saw the reason why. Reflected in it was a black house. It was the most frightening house Pongo and Mrs. had ever seen. Many of the windows in its large flat face had been bricked up, and those that were left looked like eyes and a nose, with the front door for a mouth. Only there were too many eyes, and the nose and the mouth were not quite in the right places, so that the whole face looked distorted.
"It's seen us," gasped Mrs., and it really did seem as if the eyes of the house were staring at them from its cracked and peeling black face.
"Well, that's Hell Hall for you," said the cat. She moved on, and they followed her round the curving wall. After a few minutes, they saw a tower rising high above the treetops. It was built of rough grey stone, like the wall, and was rather like a church tower. But there was no church. The tower simply jutted out of the wall. Some of the narrow windows were broken, and their stonework was crumbling. The place was not yet a ruin, but looked as if it quite soon might be one.
"Well, may they call it a folly," said the cat.
Mrs. did not know what the word meant, but Pongo had seen a folly before and was able to explain. "The name is often given to expensive, odd buildings built for no sensible reason, buildings that it was a foolishness to build." The cat meowed three times, and there were three answering barks from inside the tower. A moment later came the sound of a bolt being drawn back.
"The Colonel's the only dog I ever knew who could manage bolts with his teeth," said the cat proudly.
Pongo instantly decided he would learn to manage bolts.
"Come in, come in," said a rumbling voice. "But let me have a look at you first. There's not much light inside yet."
An enormous sheepdog came out. Pongo saw at once that this was none of your dapper military men, but a lumbering old soldier man, possibly a slow thinker, but widely experienced. His eyes glittered shrewdly and kindly through his masses of grey and white woolly hair.
"Glad to see your large Dalmatians," he said approvingly. "I've nothing against small dogs, but the size of all breeds should be kept up. Well now, what's been happening to you? There was a rare to-do on the twilight barking last night, when no one had any news of you."
He led the way into the folly, while Pongo told of their day with the spaniel.
Sounds a splendid fellow," said the Colonel. "Sorry he's not on the barking. Now, tuck in, you two. I provided breakfast just in case you turned up."
There was plenty of good farmhouse food, and a deep round tin full of water.
"How did you get it all here?" asked Pongo, astonished.
"I rolled the round tin from the farm, with the food inside it," said the Colonel. "I stuffed the tin with straw so that the food wouldn't fall out, and then I borrowed a small seaside bucket from my young pet Tommy. The dear little chap would lend me anything. I can carry that bucket by its handle. 6 trips to the pond on the heath got the water here. Lucky it thawed yesterday. Drink up. Plenty more where that came from."
The cat acted as hostess during the meal. Pongo was careful always to address her as Mrs. Willow.
What's this Mrs. Willow business?" said the Colonel suddenly.
"Pussy Willow happens to be my given name," said the cat, "and I'm certainly a Mrs."
"You got too many names," said the Colonel. "You're Puss because all cats are Puss. You're Pussy Willow because it's your given name. You're Tib because most people call you that. I call you Lieutenant, or Lieutenant Tib. I thought you liked it."
"I like Lieutenant, but not Lieutenant Tib."
"Well, you can't be Mrs. Willow on top of everything else. You can't have 6 names."
"I'm entitled to 9 names, as I've 9 lives," said the cat. "But I'll settle for Lieutenant Willow with Puss for playful moments."
"Right," said the Colonel. "And now we'll show our guests their sleeping quarters."
"Oh, please," begged Mrs. "Couldn't we just get a glimpse of the puppies before we sleep?"
The cat shot a quick look at the Colonel and said, "I've told them the pups won't be out for hours yet."
"Besides, you'd get too excited to sleep," said the Colonel. "You must both have a good rest before you start worrying."
"Worrying?" said Pongo sharply. "Is something wrong?
"I give you my word there is nothing wrong with your puppies," said the Colonel.
Pongo and Mrs. believed him, and yet they both thought there was something odd about his voice, and about the look the cat had given him.
"Now, up we go," the Colonel went on, briskly. "You're sleeping on the top floor, because that's the only floor where the windows aren't broken. Want a ride, Lieutenant Wibb? Lieutenant Tiller? Oh, good heavens, cat!"
"If there's one thing I object to being called, it's plain cat," said the cat.
"Oh, quite right. I don't like being called plain dog," said the Colonel. "I apologize, Lieutenant Willow. Now jump on my back unless you want to walk."
The cat jumped on the Colonel's back and held on by his long hair. Pongo had never before seen a cat jump on a dog's back with friendly intentions. He was deeply impressed, both by the Colonel's trustfulness and the cat's trustworthiness. The narrow, twisting stairs went up through 5 floors of the folly, most of them full of broken furniture, old trunks, and all manner of rubbish. On the top floor was a deep bed of straw, brought up by the Colonel in a sack. But what interested Mrs. far more was the narrow window. Surely it must look towards Hell Hall. She ran to see. Yes, beyond the treetops and a neglected orchard was the back of the Black House, which was as ugly as the front, though it did not have such a frightening expression. At one side was a large stable yard. "Is that where the puppies will come out?" she asked.
"Yes, yes," said the Colonel. "But it won't be for some time yet."
"I shall never sleep until I've seen them," said Mrs.
"Yes, you will, because I shall talk you to sleep," said the Colonel. "Your husband has asked me to tell him the history of Hell Hall. Now, come and lie down."
Pongo was as anxious to see the puppies as Mrs. was, but he knew they should sleep first, so he coaxed her to lie down. The Colonel pulled the straw round both of them.
"It's chilly in here. Not that I feel it," he said.
Then he sent the cat to start collecting food for the next meal, and began to talk in his rumbling voice. This was the story he told. Hell Hall had once been an ordinary farmhouse named Hill Hall. It had been built by a farmer named Hill. It was about 200 years old, the same age as the farm where the sheepdog and the cat lived.
"The two houses are quite a bit alike," said the Colonel. "Only our place is painted white and well cared for. I remember Hell Hall before it was painted black, and it really wasn't bad at all."
The farmer named Hill had got into debt and sold Hill Hall to an ancestor of Cruella de Vil's, who liked its lonely position on the wild heath. He intended to pull the farmhouse down and build himself a fantastic house, which was to be a mixture of a castle and a cathedral, and had begun by building the surrounding wall and the folly. The Colonel had heard all this while visiting the vicarage. Once the wall with its heavy iron gates was finished, strange rumours began to spread. Villagers crossing the heath at night heard screams and wild laughter. Were there prisoners behind the prison-like wall? People began to count their children carefully.
"Some of the stories, I shan't tell you just as you're falling asleep," said the Colonel. "I didn't hear them at the vicarage, but I will tell you something, because it won't upset you as it naturally upset the villagers. It was said that this Deville fellow had a long tail. I didn't hear that at the vicarage either."
Mrs. had taken in very little of this, and was now fast asleep, but Pongo was keenly interested.
"By this time," the Colonel went on, "people were calling the place Hell Hall, and the Deville chap plain Devil. The end came when the men from several villages arrived one night with lighted torches, prepared to break open the gates and burn the farmhouse down. But as they approached the gates, a terrific thunderstorm began and put the torches out. Then the gates burst open, seemingly of their own accord, and out came Deville, driving a coach and four. And the story is that lightning was coming, not from the skies, but from Deville, blue forked lightning. All the men ran away screaming and never came back. And neither did Deville. The house stood empty for 30 years. Then someone rented it. It's been rented again and again, but no one ever stays."
"And it still belongs to the Deville family?" asked Pongo.
"There's only Cruella Deville left of the family now. Yes, she owns it. She came down here some years ago and had the house painted black. It's red inside, I'm told. But she never lived here. She lets the Baden brothers have it rent-free as caretakers. I wouldn't let them take care of any kennel of mine.
Those were the last words Pongo heard, for as the story ended, sleep wrapped him round. The sheepdog stood looking down at the peaceful couple.
Well, they're in for a shock, he thought,
and then lumbered his way downstairs. It was less than an hour later when Mrs. opened her eyes. She'd been dreaming of the puppies. She'd heard them barking. And they were barking. She sprang out of the straw and dashed to the window. No pup was to be seen, but she could hear the barking clearly. It was coming from inside the black house. Then the barking grew louder, the door to the stable yard opened, and out came a stream of puppies. Mrs. blinked. Surely her puppies could not have grown so much in less than a week, and surely she had not had so many puppies. More and more were hurrying out. The whole yard was filling up with fine, large, healthy Dalmatian puppies, but Mrs. raised her head in a wail of despair. These puppies were not hers at all. The whole thing was a mistake. Her puppies were still lost, perhaps starving, perhaps even dead. Again and again she howled in anguish. Her first howl had wakened Pongo. He was beside her in a couple of seconds and staring at the yard full of milling, tumbling puppies, and they were still coming out of the house. Rather smaller puppies now. And then they saw him, smaller even than they had remembered. Lucky! There was no mistaking that horseshoe of spots on his back. And after him came Roly-Poly, falling over his feet as usual. Then Patch and the tiny Cadpig and all the others. All well, all lashing their tails, all eager to drink at the low troughs of water that stood about in the yard. Look, Patch is helping the Cadpig to find a place, said Mrs. delightedly. But what does it mean? Where have all those other puppies come from? Dazed as he was with sleep, Pongo's keen brain had gone into instant action. He saw it all. Cruella must have begun stealing puppies months before, soon after that evening when she had said she would like a Dalmatian fur coat. The largest pups in the yard looked at least 5 months old. Then they went down and down in size. Smallest and youngest of all were his own puppies, which must obviously have been the last to be stolen. He had barely finished explaining this to Mrs. when the sheepdog reached the top of the stairs. He'd been downstairs getting in fresh water and had heard Mrs. howl.
"Well, now you know," he said. "I was hoping you could have had your sleep out first."
"But why are you both looking so worried?" asked Mrs. "Our puppies are safe and well." "Yes, my dear. You go on watching them," said Pongo gently. Then he turned to the Colonel.
"You come downstairs and have a drink, my boy," said the Colonel.